presentation is for mature audiences only.
Well, that counts as
it is
that.
Not intended for children, the oversensitive, or self-righteous.
Get back here.
With sticks up their butts.
Yikes.
How can you say we're mature at this opening?
It's because I blew it out of the goddamn airlock.
Language.
You're listening to the Guardians of the Kingery podcast, featuring Matt Starnslord,
Hi-do.
Carol the Cat,
hey.
The Giddy Geeker,
woo-hoo.
And Tiffany the Technician.
Hello.
People assume the time is a strict.
She was sweet and friendly. Nancy, you have to come back more often.
You've got influence.
We like the influence.
And now, damn right they shot first.
Oh, good.
The hosts of Guardians of the Kingery.
Hi-yo!
Elbowing Tiffany.
Episode 157!
Woo!
Wow! Moving right along.
I tell ya.
I know! And we're here again today with Nancy Curl of yes. Celebrating the Light. She's one of our featured artisans at our second annual Muggles Market. We can call it annual now because we've had two.
Two.
You cannot call it that's annual right. If you've had one. Little pet peeve of mine, you may have noticed. But yeah, so you are a returning artisan. So we had the joy of having you last year, and now you're coming back this year. And you're even more excited with more ideas, which we love.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, we're an audio podcast.
Be sure to check out the live video, the video we did live, though, because you get to see
yes.
the beautiful pieces.
Yes, and you can also see pictures on the website. So, and we link you over to our couple of the articles, which show even more of your pieces.
Thank
so,
you.
So definitely check that out. For those people who didn't listen to the podcast last week, we have changed our format slightly. Decided it was a little depressing to always end each podcast with the in memoriam part. So we'd rather mourn at the beginning and end with joy at the end, unless your name is Carol and you bring up somebody you remembered that died.
I wanted to say goodbye to Wallace from Wallace and Gromit.
And I appreciate that. So we're bringing it up at the beginning, then at the end last time she brought up another death. But we're going to go ahead and do that, and then we're going to talk about the news. And then we each have our guardables that we're going to be talking about, things that we feel passionately about. And so hopefully that was that. And you can jump in at any time about anything you have questions about or anything like that, Nancy. So you're one of our guardables this week. So.
All right.
But so let's... Yes.
Guardables. It sounds like something like Garanimals.
Hey, I made up Geekery. I can make up Guardables. It's like...
Guardians of the Guardables. Geekeries of the Guardables.
I just kind of think of us... You know at Trade and Try-On, we have those... If you're here in Charlotte, North Carolina, we have the statues of the four... You know, symbols of industry, and I kind of feel like we are the four at the four corners.
See, I moved here in '88, and that was a completely different intersection back then. So I was thinking.
Yes, but you're here now.
So, yes.
And so
you
know what
it is now.
It has redeemed
itself. It is uptown. It is.
Yes.
Nice.
So when you drive
touristy.
By Trade and
yes.
Try-On, think of Guardians of the Geekery
absolutely.
As we defend and protect and promote.
Cross the crosswalk, even if it says it's about to be dangerous. Go ahead.
So, speaking of things that are unfortunate, we lost another great actor this week. Stephen First has passed away.
Ooh. Who is in Animal House and probably best known in the Geekverse for Babylon 5.
Right. But he was Flounder in
He was Flounder in
Animal
House.
Is that a pledge pin on your uniform?
He did quite a few things, actually,
yeah.
And he was very active in the con circuit, and passed away this week at a very young age, I believe. He was only 56.
Yes.
From complications with diabetes.
Mm.
So, I went and had my diabetic check today.
Good.
My A1C is 6.2, so it's down from 11.5, so we are doing good.
Do
what you
goodbye,
need to
Steven.
Do.
He was a good geek.
Yes, he was. And he was beloved on the concert.
He really
not
was.
Only was he
yeah,
active, but some actors aren't always as friendly in person. And he was definitely...
He was very, yeah. Facebook
he
had
was
a
fan
a nice
favorite.
Outpouring of condolences for his family and his children. So.
Yeah, so you are first in our heart, Stephen First. And first on our list. But moving on to other things... let's talk a little bit about Atari, Carol.
Atari is launching a new gaming console. So Atari released this kind of mysterious little video, which had the old school Atari console
2600?
Yeah, the 2600 wood paneling, joystick. And
Pong?
Pong actually was a different console in and of itself. It had the little roundy things.
No, originally it had the joystick, and I had the joystick.
Yeah, it was round. It had the real, it was the dials. It was unlike
that's an obscene gesture, and I'm glad that we're audio. That's all I'm saying.
I'm fiddling with the dials.
Are you coming on to Nancy? This is outrageous, Carol.
She is our guest. Put your hands down.
Thank goodness this is audio only. My goodness.
So anyway,
they teased the old console.
They teased this old console.
I'm sorry. Now teased the dials.
Teasing and rejoicing.
Oh, boy.
But anyway, everyone thought it was going to be like the NES retro.
Okay.
Where they release all of the old Atari games. But then I'm thinking, what Atari games are we, like, itching to play? I mean, because I really want to get back into that E.T. the Extraterrestrial and adventure with the little...
Pitfall.
That was in television.
But they had an Atari-type version.
Activision.
Activision. Yeah. That's what I had.
So
Empire Strikes Back was fun. It was basically big blocks.
Big blocks,
that made a mosaic.
Breakout. Was Breakout Atari?
I don't know, but I played Space Invaders a lot.
I did play Space Invaders really a lot.
My mom used to call the one actor, she would yell out names. She'd be like, get the calisthenics man! Because there was one that just and she's like, get it. I love my mom because she was into the technology. I'm sorry, I'm totally interrupting you for the fourth time. But she would take that joystick, and when she couldn't get it to go left any farther, she would lean. Anyway, moving along.
So anyway, they released this video, and everyone thought it was going to be a retro remix or whatever. But according to Atari CEO, and I'm going to butcher his name, and I apologize, Fred Chesney?
Fred, you really butchered that.
I know you're an avid listener, Fred, and I apologize for butchering your last name. He says that, no, this is going to be a new console.
Oh.
Nothing, no details have really been released. Huh. Atari's last actual home console was the Atari Jaguar, which I remember from
1993. I
don't
remember that one.
Wow. Yeah, it came really, really quickly.
Two or 300.
It went really quickly. And Atari has since actually filed for bankruptcy, and this new CEO purchased it when it went into bankruptcy.
Oh.
But they're trying to release new things, and they actually do have a promotional relationship with the new Blade Runner film, because if you watch the old Blade Runner film, Atari is actually featured quite heavily because it was made in 1980.
So, and the new one does have the Atari symbol.
So just in time for Blade Runner 2049, they're going to release a new console.
They've got to do a Blade Runner game. Come on.
They gotta do it.
That's gonna be the one that comes with purchase.
Probably.
Yeah. An exclusive to them. The platform would be really good.
But they're saying it's gonna look very old school with the wood paneling.
Oh really? Wow.
I don't have a problem with that.
No, I don't either.
I mean, if we're gonna boot the reboot, at least go back to the wood paneling.
Yeah. And those 2600s go for a lot of money now
on
eBay.
Yeah. They actually
people
do.
Are really big
too,
into that,
which is amazing to me.
You know, if you can get the gaming cartridges to work without blowing in them.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I know.
Yes.
Old school gamers.
Think talking about blowing it, Han Solo movie. Losing directors left and right.
Well, they only had two directors.
Two directors. Yeah, that's a left and a right. Yep.
Yeah, so they're gone, and we don't really know why yet.
Creative differences.
But the problem is they've already started shooting. So you've got Woody Harrelson and everybody else, Donald Glover, and all these great actors in mid-shoot. So they're having to scramble because basically every day on a movie that high budget is hundreds of thousands of dollars. Sometimes that much in craft services. Some of those union guys drive a lot to Glover.
It's Woody Harrelson. He's got to have a little extra in those brownies.
He brings his own. Thank you very much.
That's right.
Him for America.
But my suggestion was to put Patty Jenkins in there, who just did Wonder Woman.
But she's got to do Wonder Woman, too.
She just has to write it right now. She's got time to get in there real quick and direct it. And I think
there's literally only weeks left in production in the original schedule.
Yeah, they actually have a release date already slated for that.
Yeah.
They better find somebody quick.
So it's about 98% there, so it's, you know, there's not much to do. It'd almost be like Josh Whedon coming in and just kind of
cleaning up.
And
which is what he's doing for Justice League.
It's odd they both quit, though. You would think if there was some sort of a conflict. Oh, they're brothers.
The Ford brothers.
I didn't know that either. Yeah. Okay. You're okay.
That's become quite popular lately. Yeah, you've got the Russo, brothers.
Maybe the guys from Stranger Things could step in. Ooh. The Knopfler brothers.
But they're doing Stranger Things too.
I know. But I think they've been working on it already. So yeah. Maybe.
Be interesting to see.
If you had a choice between Stranger Things and Star Wars to direct,
I'd say like, okay, can we take a little three-week break from Stranger Things so I can finish up the Han Solo movie?
Honestly, I think that
they asked
happen.
Me, but I said no.
Okay, well, we kind of think you were like, busy doing the podcast.
Yeah, I got to be on Guardians of the
You're
Geek
like, sorry, I'm sorry, unless Henry Cavill can be Han Solo, she's out.
I was like, can we recast this bitch? And they were like, no. And I'm like,
we're 98% done.
Yeah.
You guys got money? Come on, let's do this.
So, talking about telling a story and then recasting it in a different light, there has been a lot of viral information going out about Gal Gadot's salary for Wonder Woman.
Yes.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about
that? Yeah, so LUK posted an article about that Gal Gadot was making approximately $300,000 for her role as Wonder Woman in the first installment, and that it was the big headline was she's making 49 times less than what Henry Cavill made for the first Superman film, and that they estimated that he made around $11 million for that film. And very quickly, I mean, even for me, let's face it, the non-geek of the group that does not tend to read these type of things, there has been several articles since then that were like, no, that's not true. There's no way that they would have paid Henry Cavill that kind of money up front. And that basically the thing is that her deal is pretty similar to everyone else. Like Chris Evans apparently made a similar amount of money for the first Captain America film. Robert Downey Jr., similar amount of money for the very first Iron Man film. And that it's built in that if the film does well, they get a bonus.
They get a percentage.
And then they can renegotiate with subsequent sequels, depending on the performance. And that Henry Cavill most likely had a similar deal. So, a lot of misinformation. Obviously, I, you know, quit my job on her business team, so I can't quite report the numbers. But I have no doubt I don't think she's hurting for cash at this point. But I will say I was adequately enraged when I first read it. When I first read the first article, because
I wasn't, because I kind of figured there was a percentage deal included in it.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing, I'm sorry,
particularly with Wonder Woman, which is the movie that the executives felt wouldn't make money.
Yeah.
That you would throw extras in.
You would probably throw in a couple extra point or two into the percentage, thinking, well, we won't have to pay it out, and now they have to.
So the thing that was interesting is I read the Vanity Fair article that was a follow-up.
Yeah.
The one thing that I found interesting, because I used to have to read a lot of legal documents, is the use of the words probably and most likely and based on. So even they are not reporting whether or not it's accurate. They're just saying there's probably no truth to it. So until somebody definitively comes out and says, yes, her deal included points and stuff like that, is she in a position to renegotiate? That was an established fact. So absolutely they're going to want to sign a Wonder Woman 2 of some sort, and absolutely she's going to be able to negotiate higher from it. But some of those other things like points and stuff like that, it's most likely that happened. But we don't know exactly what those numbers are going to be.
I think it's important, like you don't know what her deal is, but that the opposite isn't true, though. Like that,
right?
Yeah.
Henry Cavill.
I would think that there's no way they would pay Henry Cavill, who at then was almost a complete unknown.
Yeah.
Unless you
not to me.
Unless you were a British drama.
But he could have had a graduated deal.
Yeah. With Robert Downey Jr., I know that they paid him well below his established, because he was coming off a whole bunch of personal shit.
Right.
And they were having actually for the first Iron Man, they had trouble insuring him.
Well,
I think the cost of his insurance actually came out from his upfront. So he was probably paid less than Gadot was for that first Iron Man film. Now, granted, the second Iron Man film, all bets were off.
I think he made like $39 million
yeah.
The second one. Yeah,
yeah, the second one was like, yeah.
Well, and he was the perfect actor yeah. for that role. He was,
which
Tony
was why
Stark.
Marvel said, no, we're gonna go with him, even
yeah.
though the production companies were like, you don't want to hire this man.
Yeah, no, it made perfect sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, in other movies that we're excited about.
Are you excited?
I kind of am intrigued. So, a couple of days ago, there was a trailer posted to Facebook for Manos Returns. Now, for most people who are in the geek world, they may be familiar with the fact that Manos, Hands of Fate, is probably the worst movie on everybody's Rotten Tomatoes list.
I don't know.
Birdemic is right in there. But it's usually in the, if you have the one top 100 list.
It's in the top 10.
Yeah, it's in the bottom top five. So Manos, Hands of Fate, really weird, quirky film. Was not, copyright was not filed directly, has always been... Public domain.
Yeah.
Which is, and it's.
That's what you get when a fertilizer salesman makes a film.
Or Tony Wiseman, Wiseau, or whatever his name was.
Tommy
Wiseau. Sorry. Not trying to drag your husband's name through the mud there, Nancy. So the salvation of Manos, Hands of Fate was the fact that Mystery Science Theater. Was it 3,000
at
the
time?
At the time,
it was Mystery Science Theater 3,000.
Picked it up and actually spoofed it as one of its movies because it was public domain. They didn't have to pay for the rights of it. And it just lent itself to the theater of riffing a movie.
Yeah.
And
nobody had heard of it until that point.
No. No. But it got quite a lot of themes. So there has been talk for a long time about... doing a sequel to Manos, Hands of Fate, and now there's somebody who did a successful Kickstarter. They're now in the process of doing a GoFundMe about the royalties of it. One of the children mm-hmm. of the director has been trying to work all these deals so that it's not allowing fan films to be able to do it, etc. But as of And so there was a lot of posting in March about it, and there was a filing that was supposed to happen in April. Well, as of the 19th of this month, they posted a trailer. And it includes the original Debbie from Manos, Hands of Fate.
Yeah.
And it's actually kind of interesting.
Well,
so
incidentally, the original Debbie was the daughter of the man who directed it and
right.
starred as the father in the movie itself.
So
Harold something, I can't remember
yeah.
his name.
So it's quite interesting. ManosReturns.com, you can go and see the trailer, you can find out more about it. They're hoping to release it later this year. They don't have a delivery date yet, but it was exciting to actually just see the trailer, just to know. And yes, the goat man does appear again, although obviously
it's
not the same
actor,
one.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, if you're looking for weird and spooky, the Here Comes a Campy Return. So, you know, when all the world around you is going badly, just go to manosreturns.com. But if you're looking for better things to do to get out of the house as opposed to sitting in front of your computer screen, make sure that you go over to charlottegeeks.com/calendar. We do have our calendar of cool stuff happening the next 2 weeks, and we did post on our Facebook page a little 6-minute video about that. So I've done a lot of talking. Let's talk about some of the guardables that everybody has. Why don't we go ahead and start with Sir Starnslord over there. You've got a couple things you're looking to talk about this week.
Sure. So the Defenders number 1 just came out, and I won't spoil it because I know you haven't read it.
Because you haven't given it to me
geeker.
Yet.
I brought it in the house. Yeah.
Now, is this with the Marvel TV lineup?
It is, which is very odd because the traditional comic book Marvel version was Iceman, Doctor Strange, the Hulk, and Silver Surfer. So it's kind of cherry picked from different corners of the Marvel universe, which was a lot of fun. But obviously, the Hulk is part of Avengers now in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So anyway, this actually is Luke Cage, who is kind of the de facto leader of the group, his wife Jessica Jones in the Marvel Universe now, and of course Iron Fist and Daredevil. and Daredevil has a different costume in the Marvel Universe, so it's very dark. And then there is a person, a character, I won't give it away, but related to the Spider-Man universe, female character, and I'm not sure if she'll become a member, but she's working in this issue, which is kind of exciting. But
Aunt May?
Yes.
It's definitely Aunt May. How did you guess that?
Okay,
cool. Yeah.
The Sally Field Aunt May or the Marissa Tomei Aunt May?
Marissa Tomei, yeah, absolutely. In my head,
Aunt May keeps getting younger and younger and younger. It's...
Yeah. They did in the comic books as well. She first started off as this frail, basically almost 90-year-old woman somehow that was his aunt, which I never could really figure out.
Right.
And they kept her 90 years old forever, and she was always passing out and then in the hospital, and I was like, she spends more time in the hospital than at the house where Peter Parker's going in now.
But, it becomes a latchkey problem. Yeah,
it was really horrible.
Superhero.
Then they de-aged.
Poor Spider-Man.
Then they de-aged her because she was cute and these type of things. So. But yeah, the comic book is actually good. It's a lot of setup, but I think the Spider-Man related character helps pull all the team together as far as giving a different perspective on them.
So, really? She just puts a web around them and pulls them in?
No webs involved. It's just a Spider-Man, traditionally associated with Spider-Man, I'll say that.
Oh.
So, I won't spoil it for you again, but yeah, I'd say pick it up. It's written by Brian Michael Bendis, who started off actually writing comic books about like Elliot Ness and a bunch of gangster type of stuff, and then he got into the Marvel Universe with Ultimate Spider-Man is how he got into the whole superheroics. But he created Jessica Jones, and that series was called Alias back in the day. It was a Max series, which was basically their rated R line where they could curse and show sex and stuff like that.
Fun stuff.
Yeah. So. But anyway, pick it up. It's a pretty good read, and we'll see where it goes. And perfect timing because Defenders is coming out on Netflix. So. Yes, yes, yes.
All right. Tiffany, would you like to talk to us next about your Guardable?
So, I have not been to the movies in a while, unfortunately.
You?
And I know, unfortunately, I have not. But I decided to re-break my cherry last night and go see the movie Rough Night. And boy, was it, because this is not a good movie.
Oh, no.
Well, I will say this. So the person I went with has the most magnificent giggle, and so hearing him laugh at everything that was not really that funny was pretty funny.
Oh, Elsie?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
But,
so he riffed it without really having to say anything.
Exactly. I texted him like 15 minutes into the movie, and I went, I despise this movie. And he goes, I love it! but no, there were some genuinely funny parts in this film, which stars Scarlett Johansson, as we know from every other film, Kate McKinnon from
She's only 22.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so Zoe Kravitz, which most notably was in Big Little Lies this year, which was a big hit. Ilana Grazer, which is in Broad City, which, by the way, if nobody's ever seen Broad City, is incredibly funny. Incredibly, incredibly funny. And Jillian Bell from Workaholics, and it was written and directed by Lucia Anello, which is one of the writers and directors from Broad City as well.
Hmm.
And
Kate McKinnon, right? You said her.
I said her, yep. Kate McKinnon is an Australian. Pretty good accent, I think, anyway. But yeah, basically about a group of women that get together and go down to Miami to celebrate. Scarlett Johansson is getting married, so it's her bachelorette party. So it's like the women's hangover. Of course, someone dies and they
try
to handle the situation. And
was it a stripper?
It was a stripper.
No way! You can't write this stuff.
Didn't they do this already, though? I seem to recall a version where it was guys.
Yes.
And it was a hooker.
Yeah.
Bachelor party, right?
No, I thought, no, that was way too... Tom Hanks would never do something with a dead hooker in the bathtub.
Oh, no, I know what you're talking about. Because, yeah, the guy accidentally puts the hooker on this...
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Look in the back of the door.
Is that like Vince Vaughn or the guy
who
the guy who directed Jumanji?
Yeah, it was horrible.
Yeah,
it was absolutely.
It was
horrendous.
It
was gross.
It was gross, and I don't remember it being funny either. It's supposed to be funny, but it wasn't.
No.
So like this is like something
like
kind of similar happened. Yeah. So.
Oh no.
It's just. I mean, there are some genuinely funny parts in this film, like. It's kind of a different spin. The husband-to-be has his bachelor party at the same time, and they're, like, sipping wine in like a like a wood paneled room, and like, oh, I taste the oak in this, all and right. stuff like that. And it's pretty funny. And then the fiance, the husband to be, kind of goes on a road trip, and it's he's actually quite funny in this role. But so there's some really good parts, but like, I ultimately did not believe these people were friends whatsoever. And I don't...
You didn't believe they were friends at all?
I didn't believe they were friends, and the storyline was completely implausible, and I just...
It was the Hangover.
Didn't really enjoy it. But yeah. The Hangover was funny. I think the thing is like, I like that they tried to take the approach of, like, women are raunchy, too. Women are crazy, too. Women have fun, too. But it's like... The women come off looking like
they're trying too hard.
It's trying too hard. Whereas
it worked,
the Hangover,
for Bridesmaids. I think it worked.
I didn't think it really did. I didn't.
I thought
care
it worked better than a lot of things, but I don't own it.
Yeah,
it's not like I just feel it's one of those things where it's like, well, men did this, let's have women do it, and it'll be just as good.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, can you write something original?
Isn't Rough Night the one too that's out, and there's two versions?
Is there?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, there's like...
Two versions.
Is there like a...
There's a movie out right now, and there is literally like...
An NC-17?
No, a black, an African-American version, and a Caucasian.
Oh, you're right. Okay, because we saw the preview for one that's going to have like Jada Pinkett and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's basically...
Yeah.
It's just
that
like...
That looks funnier, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate, because they do that, too, with like Steel Magnolias. They redid it as a, you know... As
yeah.
A,
oh, right.
But, you know, I just...
God, there was another movie that came out recently where I was just like, I don't need a male movie remade with just female characters.
You just wonder who's in the room when this gets pitched.
Yeah.
Based on what you're saying. It's kind of like, okay, we're going to take the Hangover.
We're
going to... With Bridesmaids. And then Weekend at Bernie's. And it's just going to be amazing.
I mean, really, at one point I was like, what is this, Weekend at Bernie's? Because they're dragging this damn body everywhere.
Oh, they did.
They really did. And, I mean, I don't know. It just didn't, the tone was off. Like, that's all, like, the best thing I can say about it. It's like, it just did not feel right. And maybe, like I said, the chemistry. I mean, everybody was good. It's weird seeing Scarlett Johansson try to play, like, a...
Funny role.
A comedic role, to be perfectly honest, because she's so intense in her past projects. I mean, not that she's not
capable.
Trying for all that she's worth. She's good, but yeah. I would not recommend spending $10 to $12 to go see this. It's, you know.
This is a watch it while you're doing your laundry 4 months from
100%.
Now.
100%. Can I give a warning real quick? It's not on the itinerary for about a movie I rented from Netflix, and I think you've seen the stinker.
Okay.
Office Christmas Party.
I have not, actually.
$1.50 at Redbox, sorry. But,
and it was too much.
And it was too much. It was last Friday, I had the afternoon off, and I was like, there's nothing at the cinema I wanted to see. And I was like, oh, I missed this, I'll get this. It has some people I like in it. Jennifer Aniston, and it's by the people that made Horrible Bosses, which I like the first one, the second one, whatever. It was the most horrible waste. I barely could get through the thing. Hmm. I don't know why I actually finished it, but it was
what
not...
What was bad about
not,
it?
It was... Nothing was funny, and it was just so... And I like stupid stuff. Like, I'll watch an Adam Sandler thing and find something, a little shred of humor in there somehow. But there was nothing funny to me at all, and I was like, these are so many talented people.
Didn't you say it took, like, forever to get the actual party part, too?
Yeah, I was like, they're not going to have enough time to have the party. And it was probably the last 20 minutes they had the party, and I was like, oh, finally, this has to blow it out here. No, it was just not funny either. And I was like, wow, just so disappointing. But,
it's kind of how I felt about Sisters. With Tina Fey and Amy Poehler.
Oh,
no, I didn't see that either.
You never yeah.
All right, I'll avoid that one too.
Yeah.
Oh, so disappointing.
Avoid that one
too. All right.
So you watched a special on Netflix along with your Redbox.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah. So Tracy Morgan, this is his special is called Staying Alive.
So was it a documentary about the Bee Gees? Did he?
No, but the beginning is a shot-by-shot recreation of the opening of Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, God.
He's wearing the white suit, but he's wearing the white suit. And he's walking down and the music's playing. And he has, he goes to get the pizza and he's like, three slices. And he goes, he's trying to get three slices. Very funny. This really reminds me of, and then he comes and he's wearing the white suit on stage to do the special. And it was really funny. And it also kind of reminded me of, after Richard Pryor had his accident where, I guess an accident, he was smoking crack cocaine and caught on fire. Sorry. Oops. Sorry, Richard. But so it had some of those very real raw commentaries on life and just coming out of something. And then he's talking about having sex with his wife and just, it, I mean, it was very raw. But there were parts of it that were like, had a lot of pathos to it too. So it was a little bit beyond comedy. So it really reminded me of that Richard Pryor phase where he kind of elevated himself to almost like a Lenny Bruce type of thing where you're, George Carlin. It really reminded me of that. So I was very excited.
But maybe not so funny. Excited. It Comes at Night.
Actually, no.
What?
This isn't a bad film.
Okay.
This really isn't. But it is a terrible, terribly marketed film.
Oh.
If you watch the preview for this film, one, you assume it's a horror film. Two, you assume it's, there's zombies or some sort of monster that comes at night. There are no monsters that come at night, and it's not a, it's not really a horror film. It's more of a drama. It's a very quiet film about, there's an epidemic that is just devastating cities, and this one family have a house in the woods, and they're trying to keep, you know, the father, Paul, is trying to keep his wife and son safe, so they wear masks when they go outside because it's an airborne virus, and they have just buried his father-in-law, who, you know, these people don't come back from the dead. Once you're dead, you're dead. They just buried his father-in-law at the very beginning of the film, and they're very careful when they're outside. When they come in, they lock the door. They don't let anyone else in. It's very, they're trying to just basically survive.
Oh, and, well, I did see this.
Yeah.
The preview did look like a horror movie. Yeah. And like you're saying, some kind of zombie or
some kind of zombie or monster is trying to get through the red door. And in fact, that's not it at all. They allow another family to come in because this, the father of this other family breaks into the house thinking it's abandoned.
Oh, okay.
And they, you know, they tie him to a tree and watch him for 2 days, make sure he's not infected. And then they go bring his wife and young son into the house. But it all kind of falls apart, and I don't want to spoil it. But I'm going to, okay, dude, does anyone care if I spoil it?
I really want to know.
Yeah, okay. Tell us.
So, spoilers. The infection's already there, and in, they don't explain, but I really truthfully think that the son, the teenage son of the original family, was infected from the very beginning. And infects the young, because this couple that comes in have a toddler.
Okay.
And of course, once the toddler's infected, the father is like, you get out of the house. There's guns involved. It's very, and it's very tense, but it's, I wouldn't call it a horror film. And the posters.
It's suspense or a thriller.
Yeah, I consider it a thriller. It's more like Contagion, where only, you know, with Contagion, you're dealing with logistics and people trying to fight the disease. Here, this is just one family trying to make it through. And
so why didn't they go out at night? So they wouldn't run into anybody else?
Right.
Okay.
Because there's no electricity. They're working off gas lanterns and everything. And they don't want to leave the doors open. They want to make sure everything is locked up. So it is basically, they don't go outside at night because it's kind of dangerous. They're in the middle of the woods. But I went into this thinking it was kind of a monster film, and I was pleasantly surprised that it wasn't. It was a good film. It was very well acted.
But it's poorly marketed.
It's very poorly marketed. And I could tell, I could tell there was like, you know, there's several people in the auditorium with us, but the two couples that were on opposite sides of us were just totally disappointed because they're, you know, at the end of it, they're like, what the hell? Where were the zombies? Like, there's no zombies.
Is that a real plot and story? Oh, no.
And, you know, there's really no resolution either. It's you know, because it's just this one family, and you're just telling the story family. Yeah, you don't know what happened. You don't know what caused it.
I'm going to check that out. I really like this
actually,
type of movie.
Yeah.
So.
It's tense.
I don't like all the questions answered.
Yeah.
I like
and
I have my imagination. And
yeah, and this does not. And it is very well acted. I gave it a B. There were too many dream sequences for my taste.
Oh. Okay.
But I thought it was a good movie. But if you look at the posters and you watch the trailers, you're thinking you're getting a totally different film. And this thing was just really poorly marketed.
Okay.
Interesting. Yeah. So,
American Gods.
Should we just call it American?
Yeah. Well, I was just. I was sorry, I was going back. And so speaking of zombies and things that come at night, I watched the Doctor Who episode last week, and it was actually called The Eaters of Light. And it takes place with Bill, the companion, wanting to prove a point. She has a theory about this Roman legion that disappeared in the mists of Scotland. And she doesn't believe they actually disappeared. She believes that they're actually there. And so she and the doctor are having this philosophical argument, and they end up going back in the mists. And it also has that kind of feel, like, you know, here they are in Scotland, and, you know, these people just disappeared in the mist and at night, and what happened to them. So it's interesting that it has that same kind of, you know, you need to stay out of the dark and mm-hmm. different things like that. So it was a very interesting episode. It definitely wasn't part of the whole what's going on with Missy the Master segment as much. There is a situation where the doctor is going to fix things, and basically the people are like, no, you're not going to fix this. We're going to fix this. So that was kind of an interesting change. But I thought it was really interesting. It's definitely kind of a one-off monster of a week kind of episode, as opposed to one of those arcing
things. I don't mind that so much.
And, you know, those are good. So next week we see, or this weekend we see the return of the original Cybermen. So interested to see how that comes out. But last week's episode, definitely still in that track of worthwhile. Very enjoyable. So,
and the writer of that episode, she wrote the last episode of the Classic Who series. Uh-huh. So it was pretty interesting that they brought her back. They've done all those classic tie-ins lately.
Which
you had
nice.
Alpha Centauri,
yeah.
You had the same.
I kind of feel like they realized they did Capaldi wrong because he was such a Doctor Who fan, so
yeah.
They're bringing
Here's
back
your wish
a lot
list.
Of
yeah.
his stuff. So as somebody who's lived in England during times when Doctor Who was on, how was it for you?
I never watched television.
Yeah.
I didn't even own a TV there. I worked all the time.
I was a workaholic.
Nancy.
I missed a whole period of time.
Yeah, I have to say, so... and when Star Wars came out, the fourth episode, which was the first movie that came out, that was 1977, my parents took us to the theater to see that, and then explained to us that now we were born again Christians and we would not be going back to the movie theater anymore. So that was my last movie that I got to see in the theater. I had to wait for everything to come out with commercials and editing and everything like that, because of course when cable came on our street, we didn't get that either. And then I didn't see anything again until I was 21. So
wow.
I definitely had a lot of gap of catching up. And I remember when the first time I got my license, one of the places that I used to go was to the video rental place and try to watch all these VHS tapes, trying to catch up on all the stuff that I was missing. That my friends would see. So anytime my parents went out of town, I would rent 5 or 6 videos and just binge watch. And days before binge watching was a thing, I used to try to Netflix, but not chill, just like keep watching. I actually remember taking the couch cushions off of the couch and putting them on the floor and buying Chinese food and just sitting there and watching and trying to sleep on this couch and like not going to bed, because it's like, only got 36 hours. I've got to watch as many as I can. So, but anyway, so that was that. But American Gods finished up.
Yes, the first season of American Gods is done. It was only 8 episodes. There were supposed to be 10, but they shortened it to 8. I don't know why. This was kind of, overall, I loved it. And the last episode in particular, it landed on its feet. It really did. It stuck the dismount. Kristen Chenoweth shows up as Easter, or Eostre, the goddess of the dawn. And Odin and Shadow Moon go to her house, and they show up on Easter. So she's there with a bunch of Jesuses. Because each denomination has their own version of what Jesus looks like, and when you pray to that version of Jesus, it comes into being. Mm. So there's like several Jesuses, and they're, you know, since Jesus kind of co-opted her day, she invites them to her house. But Odin is trying to enlist her in his battle against the new gods. in particular media and technology, and Mr. World, who is still kind of the shadowy figure, played just perfectly by Crispin Glover, who I kind of adore in a really weird way. But the last episode was really great. It's been, there's a couple of episodes that didn't quite click, I think because they meandered quite a bit. It's supposed to be a road, just, the book was basically a road trip with Shadow and Mr. Wednesday, who is Odin. And in this final episode, he finally admits that he's Odin, and then promptly kills several people with lightning, because he's Odin.
That's what you do.
That's what you do.
Gotta stretch my legs. I've been in the car for a while. So.
And then Easter promptly just washes the land with famine. It's like, you want spring? Pray back. Pray to me. You want spring back? Pray to me.
So, wow.
Yeah, so the old gods are now teaming up to become relevant again, which is the whole purpose of this, is they no longer feel relevant. The sidetrack with this season has always been Shadow's dead wife, Laura, who is following him with the... she's following him with Mad Sweeney, who's the leprechaun. Her story has always been kind of hit or miss with me. I don't like her character. She's an incredibly selfish character, even when she's dead. She's incredibly selfish. But she finally meets back up with Shadow. So we're set for season two with the beginning of the battle, and they're all heading toward the house on Tall Rock, I think that's what it's called. But that's where all the gods are meeting in Wisconsin to actually battle it out. Yeah, because, you know, if you're going to...
Like you do.
If you're a god and you're going to battle media, you're going to go to Wisconsin.
So instead of winter is coming, spring has come.
Spring is...
Or Jesus is coming!
If you want spring back, you better pray. But it was... Kristen Chenoweth actually was perfect as Easter, because she was very almost... Real Housewives of the Elder Gods. She was all done up and, you know, very fancy eyeshadow, very fancy, you know, Easter bonnet and rabbits and jelly beans and everything in her household. You know, and then, you know, she lets her hair down and washes everything with famine.
Well, speaking of being pretty and then bringing pestilence, so Orphan Black is back. It's its final season. So every episode, you know that something's going to happen and characters get to die and all sorts of things. So if you have been watching Orphan Black, you know, it's about the clone sisters, a bunch of women who realize that they're actually part of a cloning project. And there are four or five key characters that have kind of bonded together, but and they've become Sistra is what they call each other. And you've got Helena, who's the crazy one, and they all have their little quirks and everything like that. But it was definitely an interesting episode. There are some of them that part of the problem is that clones start getting sick and they die. So they're trying to find a cure. They actually found out that certain parts of their body parts are like patented, so they don't own themselves. Mm. And so therefore they are not, there's the whole debate. It's kind of like the Star Trek Data debate. Are they actually humans? And do they have rights or not? And it was an interesting thing because Helena, so originally Sarah Manning, who's the main clone that you kind of, she's the first one you're introduced to and she's the one that you follow the most. She is unique because she was able to get pregnant and none of the others have been able to be pregnant. And so there's a big fascination for studying her daughter and finding out what makes them, and there's been some allusions that her young daughter has some psychic abilities and different things like that. Well, Helena, who is Sarah's twin, was born in the womb, but Sarah, of course, was raised in a foster home and different things like that. Well, Helena was raised by these crazed monk people and priests and Catholics and there's just like, you know, being raised as in a crate and tortured and all that stuff. So she's messed up in the head. Mm. But in spite of being very scary, and she was definitely scary in the first season, she's also very funny because she just has a very distinct right and wrong, kind of that Roman Catholic, this is the way it goes, but take it back to the olden days. And she actually got pregnant as well. There's just some debate. She was impregnated as part of a group that are big on the clone thing. So, and she actually has twins, but in their attempt to bring her back, she ended up getting stabbed. And there was some concerns about one of the twins. And so they took her to the hospital because they were scared, and the twin self-healed. The nurses were very interested in that. And at first you're like, okay, this is all great. And then Helena kind of snapped, like Helena does. And there's a very hard to watch scene of an epidermic needle, hypodermic needle in a face. As she decides that because she gets things in her head, and even though she doesn't, even though the people themselves may not be bad, she's just convinced that she's surrounded by bad people. So, so there was that little scary part at the end. But other than that, it's definitely sounds like a lot of the things we love, Doctor Who, Orphan Black, even American Gods are raising the bar, and we definitely have some cool stuff. So, other than that, any final words from anybody?
Any kind of restaurant review?
No.
Oh, no.
Not this week.
No. So, but come back next week because
we'll have a restaurant review. Because
Tiffany is taking on the Dionysus role of food and wine, and she's going to be guarding us with some great local restaurants that we can try out. So, make sure to check that out next week. Mm-hmm. And I think, Carol.
Am I pushing the button?
I think it's time to push the button. Nancy, thank you so much for being with us. Push it again.
You call me a pusher.
Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/guardiansofthegeekery and on Twitter at CLTGOG. Music used by Guardians of the Geekery, Lock and Load, and A Day in the Sun by Jens Kilstofka. Licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International.
Oh,